Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Hello once again and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Today we have with us Dr. Vincent Carcillo. I know him well. He's a terrific guy of Capital District Regional Physicians. And he's going to discuss nephrology. He's board certified in both internal medicine and nephrology and assistant professor of medicine at Albany Medical College. Dr. Carcillo has been with CDRP since 2004, is the current president and managing partner of the practice. No small thing. A graduate of the University of Scranton, he completed medical school at the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. He trained in nephrology at Albert Einstein Medical Center in Philadelphia. His clinical interests include transplant nephrology and hypertension. Vince, Dr. Carcillo, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Alan. It's so nice to be back. Thanks for having me.
Well, we love having you here. And Capital District Renal Physicians is some practice. You have, what, 8 full-time doctors there now?
We do. We have 8 full-time doctors, and we span between 3 cities now, between Albany, Schenectady, and Saratoga.
And you just opened up something in Saratoga.
That's right. That's right. We have a practice there that we've been developing now for the last year, and we've created a new dialysis unit there, which is a beautiful new state-of-the-art facility.
Now, we were chatting before, and you mentioned something about a belt. I wonder if you could tell us about that.
Oh, well, one of the new exciting advances in nephrology is that they're creating and they've been working on a wearable artificial kidney device for many years now. And it finally seems like they've been able to get some traction and the FDA has put it on a fast track.
So instead of going to have your blood cleansed for 3 or 4 hours, you can wear this thing all day and just continue on with your life, theoretically.
Seems like the next step in the continuum of, you know, patients who come to hemodialysis therapy at the outpatient centers come for about 4 hours, 3 times a week. And generally that's on the schedule that they need to follow because the clinics need to stay organized. So it's not always at the time that you like to be there. And again, it's quite a commitment at 4 hours plus. So home therapies, then, is another way around that, where patients are dialyzing at home, and some do hemodialysis, which is the conventional method most people think about. Others do dialysis through their belly, that we call that peritoneal dialysis. And those modalities are really nice because you get to do them on your own schedule. There's the privacy of being at home, the autonomy of participating in your own care. And now this device would be something that not only is at home, but now much more portable.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You're an expert in transplant. How often does transplant work?
It works very well, actually. And our Albany Medical College, our local transplant center, has excellent results at 1 year and at 5 years.
Wow. When you say it, 1 year and 1 year, after 1 year, you're still alive. After 5 years, you're still alive.
That's right. The goals are that the patient survives, but also that the allograft or the transplanted kidney is still functioning at those times.
Okay, so here's a middle-of-the-night dream. Somebody comes to you, you know, and says, listen, I got to have a kidney. Both of mine are damaged. Should you give them a kidney, or do you really need that extra kidney just in case something happens?
Most people who are eligible to donate a kidney do great afterwards, and they live a normal life with one kidney. They have good kidney function, normal blood pressures, and their survival is excellent.
Yeah.
So it's a noble thing to do. Not everyone is a candidate to donate a kidney. You have to go through a screening process, number one, to make sure that you are the same blood type, for instance, and that you're a good donor for the person who needs it, but also to make sure that you're healthy enough to go through that kind of procedure.
Forward, very quickly, what are some of the things that would disqualify you from being a donor?
Well, one would be if you had some form of kidney disease yourself.
Okay.
And that could span a range of anything from having a lot of protein in your urine to having significant diabetes or high blood pressure, things that would create risk for you to develop kidney disease moving on after donation.
Okay. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros, 1-800-348-2551. Go ahead, Jim. Hello, Jim. I think Jim went to the other room. Hello, Jim. Okay, Jim's off. Thank you. 1-800-348-2551. By the end of this show, I'm going to guarantee you that virtually every single phone is going to be busy because we all have kidneys and we all know somebody with kidney disease. Always takes a little while to work it out. I'm not quite sure. Okay, let's try this again. Jim, are you there? No. All right. I don't know who's on number two. My bet is that's Jim also. 1-800-348-2551. You got a kidney question? Now's the time to ask it. 1-800-348-2551. So, Vince, I know a lot of people who've died. And I know this is sort of a strange question, but quite frequently in the end, I say, well, what did they die from? And they say, kidneys. But kidneys can also be affected by a lot of other medical conditions, right?
Yes, that's right. A lot of people, and many of those people have died in the hospital setting. And there are a lot of things that can cause acute kidney injury. That some of those things are major stresses on the body, would include things like bad infections, major surgeries, that kind of thing. So kidney injury sometimes compounds someone's illness while they're in the hospital.
How do you get kidney? Somebody hit you in the kidney? Could that give you?
You can get trauma to the kidneys, and we used to see that sometimes when the Giants would be here to do their practice and training camps in
another
the summer.
Another reason not to like football. Okay, we'll go to Deb in Clarksville. Okay, Deb, you're on.
Hi, I was wondering if you could explain how lupus damages the kidneys, because I don't really understand that.
Sure. So lupus is a disease that we would call an autoimmune disease. So meaning your immune system that normally you use to fight off infections or fight off the potential for cancer cells and that kind of thing, that kind of looks inward and you start to attack your own cells. And so lupus is one of those diseases. And when that process is active, lupus can actually do damage to the cells of the kidney.
Okay.
Oh, I guess so.
Unless you have another question.
No, I just didn't really understand why it goes to the kidney. I guess lupus is just a big mystery to me.
Well,
okay.
It doesn't just affect the kidney. Lupus is a disease that can cause a lot of different organs to become affected in different parts of the body as well. Many people who have lupus experience joint issues and muscle aches. Sometimes people have brain injury. They call that cerebritis related to lupus. There's an inflammation that happens when the body is kind of looking in and attacking itself in an autoimmune way, and that can affect almost any organ in the body.
And by the way, Deb, you really started it out. Every phone is busy, and we thank you for doing that.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks, Deb.
Bye.
Yeah, bye. 1-800-348-2551. We'll take a real fast one now from Laura from Fishkill. Okay, Laura, you're on.
Hi. I've been struggling with anemia and getting iron infusions, and I've also had high blood pressure for most of my adult life. And I'm wondering if this is an indicator of looking forward to kidney disease in the future.
Well, it's a great question, and you know the two are very interrelated. High blood pressure, especially uncontrolled high blood pressure, can cause damage to the kidneys over time. If you can imagine, you know, a filter at the end of a hose, right? If you increase the pressure in that hose, the filter is going to become leakier and more damaged over time, and it's that kind of idea. It's also true that primary diseases of the kidney can lead to high blood pressure. So,
yeah. And are we doing any better on keeping high blood pressure down?
Well, you know, it's interesting because high blood pressure, we look to national guidelines to help us know what our targets are. And those guidelines have come under speculation over the last couple of years. There's a joint national committee on hypertension that convenes every so many years.
And they keep lowering what they want you to have, right?
Well, recently they actually increased the targets, and they said, well, 140 should be our systolic target for everyone under the age of 60. And above that, should maybe even higher is okay. But now a new recent trial that's just come out and still kind of being analyzed suggests that lower probably is better. So we've been back and forth in our last 10 years.
So thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Right. Okay, so let's go to our friend Jim in Matamoros. Okay, Jim, you're on.
Would you speak about renal rickets, its causes and effects on other systems?
Renal rickets that scars other systems.
Sure, Jim. So renal rickets, and so probably more importantly and more commonly is that, you know, patients who have chronic kidney disease and end-stage kidney disease do develop abnormalities in what we call their bone homeostasis. Your bones, we don't always think of them as living organisms, but they are, and your bones are constantly changing. They're breaking down, they're building up. And one of the things that needs to happen is we need to get calcium and phosphorus into the bones and take it out of the bones when we need it for other reasons like muscle health. So when you have advanced chronic kidney disease, a number of derangements happen. Many people start to develop vitamin D deficiency, which you know is a cause of rickets. Many of those people also have lower calcium than normal and higher levels of phosphorus that become more difficult to get rid of when you have chronic kidney disease. This turns on a hormone called parathyroid hormone that turns bone over, breaks bone down. And so these patients get into a scenario where bones are breaking down and turning over quickly, which weakens the bones over time. And it's more common for patients with chronic kidney disease and especially end-stage kidney disease to develop risk for fractures.
Thank you very much, Jim. Appreciate it. Okay, 1-800-348-2551. We have lots of phones up. We have two free phones right now. Feel free to call them. And we're going to just take a very short couple of second break, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Nathan Litauer Hospital, Gloversville, New York, proudly introducing the gastroenterologist specialist of Litauer, working to provide patients with comfort during colonoscopy procedures, NLH.org. Current Compliance Services, Inc., Greenwich, New York, and now in St. Paul, Minnesota, national compliance and regulatory consultants for the life insurance industry, currentcompliance.com. Saratoga Hospital announcing the completion of its new construction and renovation project featuring a new intensive care and surgical pavilion with 10 new operating suites, saratogahospital.org. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, Japanese, Chinese, and sushi bar. Dinner entrees served with soup, salad, and shrimp appetizer. Dine-in, takeout, delivery, 518-432-0358. And from Putnam County Tourism, historic sites, farm-to-table dining, kayaking, hiking, biking, and more. Putnam County, where the country begins. Online, visit putnam.org for event calendar.
Hey, Dr. Carcillo, Dr. Vince Carcillo is with us from the Capital District Renal Physicians. And he said, you know, people here who call this program really have some very good questions. And we thank you all always for doing that. Okay, so now I think that's a 5 up there. I wouldn't bet my life on it, but we'll try it. Mike, is that you?
That's me.
Okay, Mike, ask your question.
Okay, doctors. I was transplanted in 1997. In 2000, the cyclosporin I was taking for immunotherapy started making it started poisoning the transplant, so they switched me to rapamycin. Now, at the time, I was told, I asked, why don't you just start everybody on rapamycin post-transplant? And they said it doesn't work for everybody, and they don't know why. Is that still the case?
Well, another good question. So, you know, as far as cyclosporin goes, cyclosporin in the 1980s became the backbone for immunosuppression for transplant to allow people to suddenly live longer and have longer functioning transplants than they ever did before. What we didn't know at the time was that, you know, cyclosporin over time has negative impacts on the transplanted kidney, and it can cause constriction in the blood vessels that supply blood to the kidney and the little parts of the kidney that do the filtering.
The nephrons.
The nephrons, right, or the glomeruli. So, you know, over time, we've kind of lowered our targets for cyclosporin dosing. And then, subsequently, we started using less cyclosporin and more of some other newer transplant medications. Many centers now don't use cyclosporin at all for kidney transplantation. So Rapamune or rapamycin is one of the medications that is commonly used. It's commonly used in conjunction with other medications. And if you look around, most centers have their own protocols based on their own experience and what they think works best.
But it is interesting, Vince, that FDA looks at all these medicines before, they test them out, and then after, you know, a lot of people use them, they find out not quite right.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Sure. And we learn as we go, and many times it's the risk and benefit, and when you find that the benefits outweigh the risk, then many times it's worth moving forward.
Hey, Mike from Moreau, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
Okay, we'll go to Dean in Goshen. Okay, Dean, you're on.
Hi. I had acute nephritis back in 1957, and I was wondering if that was going to have any effect as I'm older now in my 70s.
Well, it sounds like you've done very well. So nephritis is something, you know, is a kind of a broad term. And
so
there are many different...
inflammation of the kidneys, itis, is it?
Yes. Absolutely, okay. Absolutely. Thank you. So,
well, I was told it was in the nephrons, that my nephrons were...
Yeah, so it's probably worthwhile to mention that you have two kidneys, and within each kidney, there is a functional unit that actually does the work of filtering the blood. And that unit that we had just mentioned with the last callers is called the glomerulus. Some people would refer to that as the nephron. The nephron, kind of in a more definitive way, also includes the little tubes that will then bring and change the urine as it's being created. But so within that functional unit, you can get inflammation, and that is nephritis. And again, there are many different types. One of them we had mentioned again on a previous caller who mentioned lupus, and lupus can cause a type of nephritis. So I'm not sure what type of nephritis you had, but if you are, and I am assuming that you said you're doing well now as far as your kidney function?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this happened back, like I said, I was 12, and now I'm 70.
There are some types of nephritis that affect children that don't have long-term damaging effects, and they can be cured with medications and don't come back.
What are the signs of nephritis, Vince?
Sometimes people will experience something very obvious, like they'll see blood in their urine, or they'll see very foamy urine in the toilet. Some will experience other symptoms, like muscle and joint aches, and they're just not feeling well, and they present to their physician, and then they find these types of urinary abnormalities where there's blood or protein in the urine, and then blood testing may also be abnormal.
Okay. Hey, Dean, thank you for calling. Appreciate it very
Thanks,
much.
Thanks, Dean.
Okay, let's go to Joe in Albany. Joe in Albany, you're on.
Hey, doctors. I have a question relative to prescriptive drugs as well as over-the-counter drugs and their effect on the kidneys. I'm on 150 milligrams daily of indomethacin for a back problem that I had. And I've been on it for over a year. So is it time for me to have a kidney function test, or is it something I don't have to worry about?
Well, Joe, let me just ask you, you know, the indomethacin is in a class of medication called non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications. In general, they're safe, and you can find them over-the-counter in the form of ibuprofen. You see them as Motrins, Advils. These are all in the same class.
Huh.
It's generally a safe class of medications, but they can, like any other medication, have side effects and some unintended consequences. If you have high blood pressure, these medications can sometimes cause the blood pressure to be higher. If you already have what we mentioned earlier as protein in your urine, which can be a marker for damage to the kidneys, those type of medications can make that worse. So it sounds like you for sure should be in touch with your primary care physician, be screened for those types of things. Again, these are relatively safe medications, but in certain circumstances, they could be a problem. So something you want to discuss with your physician for sure.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, doctor. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Joe.
You're welcome.
Okay. 1-800-348-2551. And we'll go to, Lev in Great Barrington. Lev, you're on.
Hi. Yes, I have had excess protein, albuminuria, since I was a child, I think, because I had a serious burn that burned all, third-degree burn all the way down my back. And I believe that's when it started, but it got me out of the draft because of having it. And so I've had it all my life. They picked it up, always. And I figured, somebody said it was benign because I wasn't having any kidney failure. But now I'm over 70 and I'm at 4-stage kidney failure. And I'm just wondering, my urine is like clear. But then I realized that means it's not filtering the toxins. I mean, if you have, clear or just slightly yellow urine. And, I'm trying to find out. I haven't gotten any help at all. I'm in the Berkshire Medical Center. It's been recent, but there's a specialist that I'm supposed to see. But he said come back in 6 months. But this is just recently that I got the GFR below 30. And I'm curious to know, is there medication or some way this can be treated? I went out and got some juicers at Goodwill, and both of them went on the blink. I mean, I know that there's a lot of good things to juice that can aid your kidney recovery or maybe bring it back. But also the status or availability of transplants, if it comes down to that.
Lev, you got to ask a very specific question here because we got a lot of people behind you. Go ahead. What's your question?
Well, I think the question is, I'm at a loss. I'm already dead in. I went on the internet to try to find information, and I just can't come up with any information. I'm very bad using the internet, but I mean, they have quite a lot of things, but they're always selling you something.
Okay, Lev. Lev, stay put for a minute. We're going to ask the doctor to comment on your comment. Go ahead, Doc.
Okay, Lev. So, there were obviously a number of different pieces to what you had just said. Having a form of kidney disease in your youth, having protein in your urine, having this GFR.
Well, I didn't consider disease because nothing was different. Oh, I know. I originally went to the doctor because I was feeling overtired in college. I couldn't understand what was going on. But anyway, I haven't had those symptoms again until just currently, that's the only symptom I have is being, getting exhausted when I go out and do, errands and things like that.
Lev, let's let the doctor continue.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
All right. Go ahead.
That's okay, Lev. So, so to focus on what you just said is also true for many people, and we'll see patients in the office frequently who feel fine. And they didn't realize that anything was wrong, but maybe it was for a life insurance physical, or maybe it was just for a yearly physical with their primary care physician. They found, that you have protein in your urine. And yes, I've heard other patients say that, that kept me out of the military too. So
yeah, 10,000 over, 10,000 times as much protein as normal.
Well, so anytime you have protein in your urine, it's very reasonable to have a nephrologist or a kidney specialist take a look at the situation, because there are a number of reasons that you can have that. Some are less serious, some are much more serious. So the other point that I would make is, you mentioned GFR, and some patients or some people listening might not know what that is. So when we look at patients' kidney function, one of the things, and we've been talking about it, is, what is the character of the urine? Are things that are not supposed to be there getting in through the kidney's filter? Bigger components of the blood, like blood cells and proteins, that normally don't make their way through the kidney's filter. When they're there, it doesn't necessarily give us a diagnosis. but it should put up a red flag to say, hey, why are these things here? We should investigate that. And the other way that we can take a look at kidney function is to look at the blood work. And there is a specific test that we use that's called creatinine that's commonly tested by primary care doctors and other doctors alike, which tells us about kidney function.
This has been done. They've been doing kidney panels for years.
Sure.
I know all about it.
No, Lev, we know you know, but there may be people listening.
GFR is just a function of that. If you want to tell the audience, it's a function of the bond and creatinine formula that works out.
Well, these tests are actually, believe it or not, that although we use creatinine as a marker for our kidney function, it's something that doesn't come from kidneys at all. Creatinine is actually something that comes from our muscles, and that's why we use it as a marker for kidney function, because it's easy to test and everyone has muscles.
Yeah.
As your muscles are active, you make more of this stuff, which is like a waste product, and the kidneys filter it out. So you should be in balance. Every day making more, every day getting rid of more, and with that, your level should stay pretty much the same. As we see those levels rising in the blood, indirectly it tells us, hey, kidneys are not doing their job, and this stuff is backing up.
Lev, thank you very, very much. Appreciate it. Let's go to numbers here. Don't look too good. Okay, let's go to Sarah. Okay, Sarah, you're on the road. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm wondering what a person can do to prevent kidney stones.
Okay, Sarah. So there are a number of things that people can do to prevent kidney stones. You know, most people in the general population don't make kidney stones, and they don't make kidney stones for a reason. You know, the body makes substances that make their way into the urine that keep things that come together to create stones, like calcium and phosphorus, apart. So if you've made kidney stones before, and many times people who have made one kidney stone, again, never make another one. But if you're someone who does have tendency to make kidney stones, one of the most important things to do is if you have a sample of one of the stones that passes, to analyze that and then find out what kind of stone. There are different kinds of kidney stones that people make. Once you know that, then you can really target specific ways to decrease the incidence of that. But a very easy way to prevent stones from becoming a problem is to keep yourself well hydrated.
Yeah.
Okay.
Adding on to Sarah's good question, is it so that there's a familial pattern with kidney stones?
In some people, there is. In some people, there are specific diseases. Sometimes people who have parathyroid problems can create more stones. Some of those patients have more calcium in their urine than they should. Stones, for the most part, are calcium-based. So calcium comes together with phosphorus, and again, kind of touching on something that we had said earlier, calcium and phosphorus are what make up your bone.
Okay, so, but going back, when you pass a stone, which is no easy thing, obviously, you want to get it, but you have to scoop in the toilet to get it, right? Is that what happens?
Yeah, and if it's a person who's made kidney stones before,
right?
What we'll sometimes do is have the person use a strainer. And that way, you know, as they pass, well, then you can collect that, what is more like a sandy material, sometimes not a very big stone, at least we hope so.
Well, I hate to get graphic here, but how do you do that? I mean, you know, if you're peeing in the toilet, doesn't the stone go down the toilet? Isn't that a problem?
It could, and that's why it's sometimes helpful to use a strainer.
A fine strainer
so that you can strain that liquid, and hopefully if there is a stone, you can catch it before it's lost.
Anything else, Sarah?
No, thanks. Except maybe, is there anything to avoid, like certain foods or...
There
like
are some things
like
that you
gout
can avoid.
Things, you know, like asparagus or stuff like that. Is there something in this area that you should avoid?
Sure. Well, you know, one of the, the top things are, one, keep yourself well hydrated. Number two, keep your sodium intake down. You know, if you've made stones before, keeping your sodium intake down below 2,000 milligrams is helpful. What you do not have to avoid are things like dairy, which is counterintuitive to what many people would think. Mm. What you should, though, avoid are things like supplementation of calcium and vitamin D, which can be a problem.
And vitamin D. So if you don't take the vitamin D, you're damned. And if you do take it, you're damned.
It can be tricky. It can be tricky in some people who are making stones like that. Yeah.
Hey, Sarah, great call. Thank you so much. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We're going to take a small, short, very short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the Nature Conservancy's Adirondack chapter, working to preserve freshwater resources that flow from the Adirondacks to New York's urban centers. nature.org/Adirondacks. Ellis Medicine, offering treatment for people with chronic back, neck, and headache pain at the Ellis Neuroscience Center. ellismedicine.org. Nine Pin Cider, serving New York hard ciders made from locally sourced apples. Tasting room open Wednesday through Saturday at 929 Broadway, downtown Albany. Be revolutionary, consider the apple, ninepincider.com. College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair services and 24-hour towing and recovery service for over 30 years, collegestreetmotors.com. And from the Urological Institute, offering urologic oncology services with prostate specialists using active monitoring protocols designed to help avoid or postpone cancer treatments through imaging and genomic testing. UrologyOncology.com.
And we are back, and several phones are busy. Four phones are busy. We have one free phone. Somebody just wrote and asked about a recent study combining what Celebrex and ibuprofen. Do you know anything about that? Have you heard about that one?
Well, ibuprofen, as we mentioned earlier, is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medication, and they can have negative side effects on the kidneys. When Celebrex, which is a newer medication, but certainly not a new medicine, came out, it does affect people in a similar way to non-steroidals, but with some different pathways, and so it was thought that this might be a safer drug for patients with chronic kidney disease. But we do see some of the very same types of problems that we see with ibuprofen and other non-steroidals with Celebrex as well.
Interesting. Okay, let's go to Joseph in Rotterdam. By the way, folks, we're in the last third of the show, so we're going to try to keep it all short. Go ahead, Joseph. We'll give you an answer as fast as we can.
Hi. I heard you tell a prior caller that to stay well hydrated. How many glasses of plain water do you have to drink in a day to stay well hydrated or to maintain kidney health?
A very good question, Joe. So what I would do is preface that by saying everybody's a little bit different. If you don't have any medical problems and you're eating a normal diet, I don't think that you need to be fixated on how many glasses of water you're drinking. Most times our water intake should be okay. And when you're thirsty, drink, you know, and when you're not thirsty, I don't think that people generally need to force themselves to drink water. Now, there are some circumstances where you really do need to force, and, you know, there have been some recommendations of 8 ounces of water a day. Mm. So, you know, in a previous caller who called about kidney stones, that person wants to be taking in more than that. In a person who has issues with high blood pressure, you have to be careful how much water you're taking. If you're not watching your sodium intake, you can cause a lot of swelling that way. Patients who have heart failure have to be very careful about how much fluid they take in. So, you know, I think for the general population, you know, that, you know, 8 glasses or around that is fine. And again, I don't think that we need to be fixated on the number.
What if you're like me and you don't drink any?
Well, so many of us are so busy during the day that we don't get the opportunity, or at least the perceived opportunity, to drink water. But, you know, we should have several glasses of water during the day at work.
Okay. Thank you so much for that. Appreciate it. Let's go to Jim in Adams. Jim in Adams, you're on.
Good afternoon, doctors, both.
Dr.
Good afternoon.
And my maternal grandmother died of what they termed back then in the early 1940s, whatever, Bright's disease. Would that have anything to do with jaundice or yellow jaundice or not? And she also was very nauseous during her lifetime. And my mother related an experience of having to sit with her and taking care of her and needing to eat something, but she couldn't cook any food in the house. It made her so nauseous. So she would eat some handfuls of just oatmeal in the cupboard. My grandmother would still get the odor of the oatmeal and complain about it and groan.
Okay, yeah. So let's take it from the beginning. What is Bright's disease, Doc?
Well, you know, Bright's disease, we'll hear this a lot in people who will say, you know, my grandmother or my great-grandfather, they said, had Bright's disease. And it was, in some ways, kind of a generalized term. We're much more aggressive now at really specifically targeting what exactly is going on in the mm-hmm. kidney. And sometimes blood work and physical exam can only get you so far. And what we do in many cases now is a kidney biopsy. And that has given us much more specific terms for what's going on within people's kidneys. You heard us mention the term nephritis before.
Right.
So, you know, in your grandmother's case, it seems to me very likely that she had chronic kidney disease of some sort.
Yep.
And it probably wasn't well described, and therefore they used the term she had, you know, Bright's disease of the kidney.
And when you have severe, maybe end stage kidney disease or stage four, are you likely to get nauseous? Jim's other question.
As kidney function declines over time, there are symptoms that we refer to, and we have a term for that we call uremic symptoms, and those symptoms can include things like nausea, weight gain with swelling, sometimes itchiness to the skin, and sometimes kind of an abnormal metallic taste, as if you ever put a penny in your mouth, that kind of abnormal taste in your mouth.
Or drank a diet soda.
Just
kidding.
Sure.
Okay. Hey, Jim, thank you very much.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It. Okay, let's go to Christine in Mount Tremper. Okay, Christine, go.
Hi, guys. I'll be quick. I was wondering, on the same line of kidney cleansing, I've seen on the internet, and people have told me about kidney cleansing recipes where you can put lemon juice or maple syrup or some such in a gallon of water and drink that over the course of a day and help, you know, flush your kidneys and keep them clear. Is there any truth to that? And that other guy, Lev, who called, in his condition, can something like that help him?
Okay, well, as far as cleansing the kidneys go, the kidneys are filtering your blood. And so they're going to keep filtering the blood as long as there's blood to filter, and that blood is coming through at the right volume and the right pressure. And so if you keep yourself hydrated, whether it's with water or with juice, your kidneys are going to be happier than they would if you were not drinking. So there are some specific things. You mentioned lemonade. A previous caller had called about kidney stones, and sometimes we do, and again, once we've analyzed the situation a little bit better, lemonade is sometimes something that we do recommend that they drink, and that it has things
sugar
to do with their, not so much the sugar, but the acidity, the pH of the urine, and the types of things that are found in citrus.
Okay.
So again, we make those recommendations more specifically from patient to patient, but overall, hydration is the key. And I don't think that spending money on something specific that's kind of targeted to say this is a kidney cleanser that carries a lot of validity.
Now I know you don't want to go here, Vince, but there are some frauds out there on the internet, aren't there?
Oh, certainly. I was just specifically talking about things like putting some maple syrup, lemon juice, and maybe a pinch of cayenne pepper. These are things that I've heard that people have mentioned to me that I've seen on the internet. I'm not one for buying everything that I see on the internet.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. Thank you so much, Christine. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah. Bye. But there are frauds on the internet, and there are people who lead, you know, different groups and do all that kind of stuff.
The supplement industry is a billion-dollar industry.
Yeah.
This is a big business industry. They spend a lot of money on advertising campaigns, and you'll notice on every bottle There's a statement that says the product is not tested by the FDA, that these are not intended to sure. diagnose or cure illnesses.
Sure. Okay. And then they go and they sort of tell you that it is. We'll go to Ellen in East mm-hmm. Hampton. Okay.
Yes.
Ellen, you're on. Ellen.
Hi.
Hi, you're on.
Hi, Ellen.
Hi, I've got a question. I'm wondering how and why symptoms of kidney infections presents differently in men and women.
Sure, Ellen. And you know, it's a very good question, actually. You might also ask the question, why do women seem to get more urinary tract infections than men? It's not something that you hear a lot of men talking about, and so mm-hmm. and you do hear that much more in women. And there is a reason for that within the body, and a lot of it has to do with kind of the anatomy of the organs. You know, mm-hmm. your kidneys are creating urine. That urine then travels down a tube called the ureter that goes to the bladder. And that's where the urine is stored until you pass your urine. And when you pass it, it passes through another tube called the urethra. And so mm-hmm. in males, just because of the nature of their anatomy, that tube has to be a lot longer. And so with that, a lot less likely for bacteria to make their way back up the tube and into the bladder to cause infection.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, Ellen, thanks for the great call. Appreciate it.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye. Yeah.
Let's go to Kathy in Albany. All right, Kathy in Albany, you're on. Hi, Kathy. Kathy, you know, some people make the big mistake of listening on the radio, and there's like an 8-second delay.
Uh-huh.
So when I'm yelling Kathy, if she doesn't have that phone in her ear,
she's not hearing.
She's messed
Kathy.
Up.
Hello.
Kathy, hello, Kathy. We've been waiting for you. Go ahead.
Sorry, it's Jackie. That's why I didn't respond.
I see. Okay. Sure.
Hi, I have a question for the doctor. My family member has a problem with kidney stones and acute kidney injury. And some people have told us that black tea, more specifically iced tea, is a causative factor. But I tried to do some research online, and it seems like some studies say that it is and some studies say that it's not. And I was wondering if the doctor's weighing in.
To cause kidney stones?
Cause kidney stones and acute kidney injury.
So kidney stones and acute kidney injury, as the stones are forming, they generally are not necessarily affecting the function of the kidney. That being said, sometimes the stones do get large enough, and we mentioned there is that tube that carries urine from the kidney to the bladder. As that stone starts to make its way into that tube, it can get stuck if it's large enough. And if it's large enough, it can block the flow of urine. And now you've got a kidney who wants to filter blood, and now there's back pressure from the urine, and it can't do that. And so many times the kidney function can become abnormal. The other issue is that sometimes those stones can become a nidus for infection. And when they get infected, you can have problems with kidney function related to infection as well.
Is that something that you guys do, or is that bladder people? Who does that? Or urologists? Who handles that?
Many times, especially when stones are yeah. large enough where they need some kind of manipulation, whether that be breaking the stone up
right.
or retrieving the stone in some way, this is now in the realm of the urologist.
And they can have those busted up with what,
lithotripsy?
Lithotripsy, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. With radio waves, yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Well, Kathy, anything else on that?
I was just wondering, she likes to drink black tea, and somebody was telling black iced tea, and a lot of people have told us that black tea can cause kidney stones. And I tried to look it up online, but it seems like there are studies that say it does and studies that say it doesn't, and I was wondering if there's any definitive on that.
Nothing definitive that I'm aware of, and I imagine, you know, it would matter where the tea is coming from and what are the components of it. In any event, with these kidney stone episodes, with every person, it's important to try to document what kind of stones they're creating. And that may be why you're finding this on the internet, which is some people are forming stones for different reasons than others.
Okay.
Kathy, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Always
Thank
interesting.
You.
Yep. Let's go to Amy and Lee. Okay, Amy, you're up.
Hi, a quick question. My nephew had donated a kidney about 3.5 years ago, and over the last 6 months, he's been being tested, and they think he needs a kidney transplant. I'm curious if this is because he donated a kidney.
Well, it's difficult for me to say, not knowing him well, but this is certainly not what we would hope for in a person who's donating a kidney. As I mentioned earlier, we try to evaluate those patients and make sure that they don't have risk for kidney injury down the road, that they don't have advancing chronic kidney disease, or even if it's early from diabetes or high blood pressure, that they don't have a strong family history or genetic component that may predispose them to having kidney disease down the road. So I don't know what's happened with him, but I'm sure that he's under the care of a nephrologist now. Is that right?
Yes, he is.
Yeah. So that's important to know, is what's happened. Is this something that's new and unexpected? Many times primary diseases of the kidney do come out of nowhere, and so that certainly is possible.
It's also one of the reasons people listening might think twice about, I know you're not going to want to hear this, but donating a kidney.
Sure. Well, I mean, as I mentioned, you know, kidney donation is a very noble thing, and some people will donate to a family member or a spouse.
Sure.
We've even had patients, people in the area come and donate a kidney altruistically and say, you know, I'm sure there's someone that needs a kidney. Yeah. I'd like to donate. And it's a very special thing, and we certainly support that. But obviously, you want to be in the right hands, making sure that you've been evaluated properly and that we feel confident that you're going to do just fine afterwards.
Can kidneys be harvested after somebody dies?
They certainly can, and in most cases, they do. So there is a difference in outcomes. Living-related kidneys tend to have the best function long-term.
Living-related?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But what we call cadaveric kidney, or a kidney that comes from a deceased donor, can be very functional.
Yeah. Okay, we'll go to Mary in Hyde Park. Okay, Mary, you're on. Go, Mary.
Yes, doctor. I'd like to ask, what does it mean when you have a urine test that blood appears? I've been tested numerous times, and it always comes back negative, and I find that my dad and I have a cousin and a couple siblings that have the same issue. Is it just a genetic?
Well, another very good question. So, you know, blood in the urine can have a multitude of sources. And so blood can be coming from those filtering units way high in the kidney that we mentioned earlier, which would sometimes indicate a primary disease of the kidney. Many times that's also accompanied by protein that we also mentioned earlier, other markers of damage. But blood can also be coming from things like kidney stones as they rattle around in those tubes can cause bleeding. That can come from infection. It can come from a number of sources. Can come from cancers. So it's important when you do have that to get evaluated, and it sounds like you have. There are some types of scenarios where we do see familial problems that you can, you know, have a generation of people, multiple generations with blood in their urine.
But you can have proteinuria without it being blood, right?
That's right. You can have protein and no blood, and you can also have blood and no protein.
And if it's no blood, where can it come from? What's the protein, potential of protein?
Well, protein most always comes from those filtering units
because
the protein is coming from blood.
I see. Okay. So, Mary, thank you very much.
Yes.
Let's see
thank
here.
Thank you.
Tom, we have, I don't think so. Tom, we have only time for a very, very, very fast question. Go ahead. What is it?
I have a multiple myeloma and diagnosed with kidney problems and 77 years old, and my creatinine been running about 240 to 270 over the last 3 or 4 years. I was wondering what I can do to keep that creatinine down to acceptable level.
Okay, that's got to be it, Tom. Vince, you have an answer to this?
Sure. And it seems like the time goes so quickly.
It does. And I'm sorry about that. I apologize.
Well, you know, to try to answer your question as quickly but efficiently as I could, I would say that multiple myeloma, many people may not know, is a type of blood cancer. And so that it can affect the kidneys. The what we're seeing there is parts of your immune system building up in other organs. And so one of those is the kidney. The best treatment is to make sure that the myeloma is well treated and controlled.
Tom, I wish we had more time, but we do not. Okay, we're out of time. I thank everybody who called in. Underwriting support for the Vox Pop comes from Bassett Healthcare Network, providing healthcare services across central New York. Quote, we see people, not patients. Bassett.org. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been the incomparable Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz, a super volunteer and a wonderful guy. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. She does a great job. I'm Alan Chartok. Vince, thanks for being with us. Stay tuned now for a news update.